I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, the feeling of joy and how the most everyday and sometimes sad experiences can bring unexpected delight.
Pick up basketball, where a handful of people come together at a court that no one owns and negotiate the ways that they're going to play together. There are all of these rules that are not really written down, that are understood, which is that we're going to figure out how to be together.
And later, how a son connects with his dying father and discovers the essential ties between joy and sorrow.
And my father, who, like so many people, lived a fairly alienated life, a life separated from whatever you'd call it, just say connection. That toward the end of his life, he was really wanting to know who he was connected to, who he did belong to. That's so moving to me.
Poet and essayist Ross Gay ponders his sources of joy, from caring for his father to skateboarding, gardening, and playing pickup basketball. That's all coming up on Life Examined. At a time when so many around the globe face daily hardships, it may seem slightly trivial to focus a discussion around joy. But joy is perhaps what sustains us. It's what puts a smile on our faces, connects us with each other, and helps us to see life from a brighter, more positive perspective. Material goods or money are not a prerequisite, as joy is often found at the least expected times and in the most unanticipated places. So how do we embrace joy, especially when faced with disappointment, hardship, or sadness? Is it possible to capture and keep that feeling? How do we incite joy within ourselves? In his latest collection of essays and poems, Inciting Joy, author Ross Gay ponders the kinds of experiences that have touched his life and brought him joy. From pickup basketball games and skateboarding to fighting injustice and caring for his father, Gay explains the many ways that joy and sorrow are deeply intertwined. Joining me now for the full hour is Ross Gay, poet, essayist, and professor of English at Indiana University. Ross Gay, welcome to Life Examined. It's great to have you back.
Good to be with you.
I'd love to start with a reading as a perhaps a way to frame how we can talk about this great book and this idea of joy. So tell us what you're going to read from.
Well, I'm going to read from this kind of introductory chapter. And in that chapter, I'm sort of like, in a way, I'm sort of explaining maybe one of the reasons that I wrote this book, which was sort of to offer a response to you know, some people who say that joy maybe isn't serious or it maybe isn't worthy of our most rigorous study. I want to respond to that and say, well, yeah, it is. And then I kind of offer a kind of definition of joy, which the book kind of goes through and kind of continues trying to search for. And I'll just say that definition is something along the lines of what radiates from us when we help each other carry our sorrows. And then I have this. There's also a dance party at the beginning. but then there's this. Now that we've defined joy and concluded it is important, there are two guiding inquiries in this book. First, I mean to investigate what practices, habits, rituals, understandings, you know, the stuff we do and think and believe, make joy more available to us. What in our lives prepares the ground for joy? I mean to try to find out, in other words, what incites joy. And second, I intend to wonder what the feeling of joy makes us do, or how it makes us be. I will wonder how joy makes us act and feel. That's to say, I wonder what joy incites. For the first question, what incites joy? This book is a profoundly incomplete effort. And though I talk about pickup basketball and skateboarding and school and time and gardening and Luther Vandross's cover of the Dionne Warwick hit, A House Is Not a Home, I thought about but did not have time to dig all the way into joy in architecture or joy in sex or joy in the amateur or joy in play or memory or foraging or parenting or libraries, etc. I offer them to you. Per the second question, what does joy incite? I should say I have a hunch. And it's why I think this discussion of joy is so important. My hunch is that joy is an ember for or precursor to wild and unpredictable and transgressive and unbounded solidarity. And that solidarity might incite further joy, which might incite further solidarity, and on and on. My hunch is that joy, emerging from our common sorrow, which does not necessarily mean we have the same sorrows, but that we in common sorrow might draw us together. It might depolarize us and deatomize us enough that we can consider what in common we love. And though attending to what we hate in common is too often all the rage, and it happens also to be very big business, noticing what we love in common and studying that might help us survive. It's why I think of joy, which gets us to love, as a practice of survival. And it's why I've written this book.
What a great beginning. And there are so many things in there I'm excited to explore with you. And one of the first things you said was that some people questioned whether or not joy was even something fit for inquiry. Is that even serious enough for us to want to consider? So talk to me about that. It seems like it's something you heard.
Yeah, it's totally. I'm lucky in that I've been having a lot of conversations about joy, in part because, in two books of poems ago, I have a book called Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude. And then the book after that was called The Book of Delight. So, I'm sort of contending with these overlapping questions a lot. And a fairly common question is, like I said, is sort of like, do you think, at a time like this, is often the sort of, in brackets, it's appropriate or reasonable to be talking about or thinking about joy. And what is especially heartbreaking to me is when, because I'm lucky enough to get to talk to students a lot. And when young folks are like, I've been under the impression that joy is not serious and you can't really, be a writer and talk about joy.
And I suppose people are making the comparison to what life feels like now, a pandemic, political mistrust, hate, racial violence, what can feel like pretty dark times that we're living in now.
Well, I mean, and that's sort of the thing, like, it seems like it's always tough times.
Yeah, that's true.
First of all, and and it also feels like if you have a definition of joy that is something like closer to like, if joy is something about you get by cleaning your closets or like buying your Tesla, then that, okay, but that's not actually joy as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Joy is precisely that which difficulty requires us to, joy is what emerges from the difficulty, from our tending to one another through the difficulty, making it possible to survive the difficulty. Joy emerges from that. So in a way, it's sort of like the question emerges from what I consider a misunderstanding of joy itself.
Mm. Yeah, you almost talk about the alternate definition, which I think maybe is more commonly subscribed to, which is maybe more of a childlike version of joy, which is going up into, you use this idea of like going up to this nice room at the top of the house and the sun is on your face and there's a pretty song in the background and you feel yummy inside and everything is, everything is just very nice and you feel happy, right? That's the kind of other version of joy you talk about.
Totally, yeah. And I'm like, and that's sort of like this aspirational thing where in fact, this place where everyone you love is not in fact in the process of dying, It's sort of like, it's a kind of, childlike, childish, because I think childlike sort of has a kind of wonder that overlaps more with joy, but childish meaning immature, meaning like sort of incapable of contending with the fact of our lives, which is that things change, which is that we are here and then we are not, which is that, pain is a part of the existence.
Mm. So then talk about, which you just did in the introduction, but I think about this linkage between joy and solitude or joy and sorrow. Say more about that.
Zadie Smith and her essay, she has an essay, Joy, that's really really one of the inspirations actually for this inquiry, is she has an essay, and in this essay, Joy, she talks about, first of all, that she's had like a handful of experiences of joy, and she's like, that's enough, because it's kind of overwhelming. And then she also says that joy, in some way, she says that joy emerges from what is intolerable. And that to me feels like the kind of definition that I'm sort of interested in hanging around with. And so when I say that joy and sorrow are linked, I mean that joy is not that which, you know, you feel because, you know, and I don't want to be prescriptive either, but I think we might be under the impression, like I said, that joy is something that you feel because you accomplished something, or you got like a, you know, you got a sticker on your report or something. Mm. But I'm sort of suggesting that joy is actually the feeling that emanates when we figure out how to tend to one another through our sorrows, which are immense, and they do not go away, and they do not cease. That's the other thing, you know, that we don't get out of sorrow. To get out of sorrow is to get out of life. You know, it's kind of this dream of purity that I've been thinking about a lot. You know, in that room at the top of the house with the clean, you know, the clean floors, and it's all light, and you know, everything is comfortable, and you know, nary a difficult thing comes through. That's not real. It's just not a real thing. And so my question is, how do we, in the midst of our difficulties, in the midst of our profound and abiding sorrows, care for one another? And the caring for one another and what emanates from that, you know, I think it's what I'm thinking of is joy.
Mm. Well, maybe you can talk to me then about your personal journey with this word and your attempts at defining it through writing and through life experience. I mean, even at the top of the book, for example, you start with some tough stuff, like the diagnosis of cancer in your father.
Yeah, that's like one of these. The first essay in the book is me sort of telling the story of my father's death. And my father died of liver cancer in 2004. You know, it's almost two decades ago now. Mm. And I sort of like trying to understand, remember, like put it back together, both the experience of caring for my father as he was dying. It was about 5 or 6 months that he lived after his diagnosis. But also in the process of thinking about that, trying also to think about how our relationship, which was a full and complicated and loving and, you know, pretty difficult relationship, in some kind of way got cared for, you know, like the fact that I was able to, you know, move into my dad's house and sort of be with him in his dying, though we never talked about the fact that he was dying. Mm. He was dying. The fact that I was able to do that and that he let me do that and invited it, it completely changed our relationship. It completely changed our relationship. But, you know, it was also sort of a, you know, it's a profoundly difficult and beautiful experience. Mm.
It's incredible how the presence of death can force this this kind of wondrous return of relationships, or this healing when one knows there's suddenly a potential expiration. I find that story always to be so moving.
Me too. And it's just like it's just one of these sort of in a way, I suspect maybe that part of this practice I'm talking, and I talk about joy as a practice, you know, and part of that practice is to be always alert to the fact, not only that if you scratch the surface of someone else a tiny bit, you will find that, you know, they are suffering, as despite any kind of performance to the contrary, they are suffering, they have pain, they have sorrow. But also that we have this thing in common, and we're dying, yeah. You know, some of us sooner than others, some of us differently than others. But we have that in common, and that feels like a substantial thing to have in common,
yeah.
That we're dying together. And then on the other side that we love together, even if we don't love the same things, that we love, you know?
Yeah, that idea of scratching the surface of someone. I remember that there was a really great psychologist, Irvin Yalom, who wrote this book about kind of his life of being a therapist and what he's observed in human nature. And one of the points he made in the book that I'll never forget is that no matter who walked in the door from, you know, someone who appeared to be incredibly successful and wealthy to somebody living maybe the opposite of that life, whoever they were, once you scratch the surface, he always found that every person feels a little bit more lonely than you think they do. There's maybe a little bit more sadness there than you might have imagined when you looked at them just as their exterior. And I always found that to be kind of a both sad but touching realization that this is something we all share.
Totally. I mean, I love that so much. You know, just like if we, which is not easy to do, but if we, it's a practice, you know, and we sort of help each other do it. If we were to be just cognizant and like a little bird inside of us when we approach everyone, and the bird maybe is saying something like, "What's your heartbreak?" Mm. You know, I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm. So, in what way did you find the process of being with your father inciting joy?
You know, precisely because it was this experience of one, like I said, sort of a rehabilitation in a way of this relationship where, you know, like I said, like, you know, my dad was a good dad. He was like, he did his best, you know, like a beautiful, complicated, heartbroken dude. You know, who loved the hell out of me and my brother and my mom. You know, he just like, but in some ways I think we were, you know, alike. You know, my mother thinks we were very much alike in certain ways, and we struggled. We really struggled. But that last 5 months, not that we, and I talked about this in the essay, not that we like sort of intentionally like said, okay, let's we didn't go to therapy. We didn't go to therapy, but we just took care of one another. You know, or actually I took care of him. And like I said, and he allowed me to take care of him. And it was, I drove him to his treatments. You know, I tried to get him to eat when he, you know, couldn't eat. We watched stupid TV together. And in those 5 months, you know, I know my relationship with him began to change profoundly, and it continues to change to this day, you know, not to mention the fact that there are all of these other ways that heartbreak has sort of incited other aspects of care. Like my mother and my relationship has changed because of that and has deepened and has become one more explicitly of care, I would say, on my part. My mother's always been about care for me. But I feel like I, in a certain kind of way, was blessed to understand my mother's heartbreak and my mother's vulnerability and my mother's sorrow, which includes, you know, most acutely, I think, in my relationship to her father. But that's not it, you know? To sort of be able to understand, oh, right, my mother, who, you know, is the kind of, you know, not the kind of, is the source of my life and in that way has this kind of power, is also vulnerable and frail and heartbroken and devastated daily, you know, just like I am.
A lot of this conversation reminds me of a word we explored with another writer. Her name is Susan Cain, and she has a book out called Bittersweet. And I almost wonder if the way you describe joy and bittersweetness are somehow interrelated here, that there needs to be darkness along with the light in order to produce these really beautiful and complicated emotional states.
Complicated, I think, is the word. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And that's kind of like, I feel like one of the mantras in my head is like complicated, you know? Complicated because it feels like, yeah, we want to imagine things to be very simplistic and like we want to either imagine things simply sad or simply gleeful or something.
Yeah.
And I understand that because the dream of a sort of life without sorrow is a dream, you know, but I think it's also actually a nightmare. Because I think to forget that sorrow is a part of our lives means to forget that we are connected to each other. Mm-hmm. It's simple as that. Like, if you love anything, you will sorrow, you know? If you love people, if you love the trees, if you love the soil, if you love, you know, whatever, you are going to sorrow. I say something in the book about, like, unless you're enlightened, you know, and
the Buddha under the tree.
I don't know what you do. Yeah.
Right.
But that ain't me.
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. And I think of the fact that being human requires us to hold conflicting emotional states at the same time, you know, like if, when somebody dies, I could think of someone like my mother that I love her, but there are also still moments of thinking of her that make me feel angry or make me feel upset. And we want to pretend that things get wrapped up in these really neat ways, just as you say, so we can either be purely in a grief state or purely in a happy state. But I think that's true. This is a really difficult part of being human.
I think you're so right. I think you're so right. I often think, not all the time, but regularly, I think, you know, the things about me that are like the most annoying, but like annoying on steroids, some of them, when I die, you know, the people who love me will be like, man, that sucked. But God, I love that dude. You know,
I love that. You said that joy almost needs to become a practice, something that we need to learn. Can you say more about that?
Well, that's one of the real kind of inquiries of this book, I think. And I am really curious. It's for that. Yeah, I think joy needs. I think of joy as a practice. And you know, it's funny because when I had the last book, it's called The Book of Delights, and it's a collection of essays. Every day I wrote an essay about something that delighted me. And I sort of thought about it at first as a discipline, which I think appealed to me because, you know, I came up as like an athlete and stuff. But then I started thinking of it as like, no, it's a practice, which appeals to me in a different way as an athlete, but also in a kind of spiritual endeavor. So I kind of carry that over to this idea with joy, or I think about it also when I'm thinking about joy, because I think that one of the things that we're, you know, when I'm thinking about joy, when I'm thinking about us possibly doing is to, like I said, sort of be curious about the ways that those tethers between us, that sort of fundamental, foundational connection between us, which is many things, among which, like I said, that we die and that everything we love will also die or change or whatever the word is. And from that, the kind of light, the kind of care that might emanate. I'm curious about these different kinds of practices that seem to provide a kind of structure where that's always happening or where that might be happening. And so I talk about these different kind of places. I talk about, you know, pick up basketball as a site where I don't know how to say it quite yet, but like the structures of joy or something are in practice or are being built. By which I mean that in pickup basketball, again, I'm like sort of adamantly not talking about basketball with refs or coaches. I'm talking about basketball where a handful of people come together at a court that no one owns and negotiate second by second the ways that they're going to play that day together. And that when the next team comes on, the negotiation happens again. And there are all of these rules inside of basketball, pickup basketball, that are not really written down, that are understood, that in a way preserve this first thing, which is that we're going to figure out how to be together. I talk about skateboarding as a practice. And part of what I'm talking about in skateboarding is that there's these premises. One of them is that if you have extra stuff, trucks, wheels, bearings, etc., you share it. And if you don't share it, it's not good. And then the next thing is that skateboarders always remind us that those who think they own everything, maybe they don't. You know, skaters trouble the idea of private property. skaters trouble the idea of like who's allowed inside and who's not, you know, who's allowed in spaces and who's not. The gardening, of course, is a kind of practice that I think of as also deeply one of these places where you can kind of see joy in action. And one of the things that I think, in addition to being perpetually reminded that we are indebted forever, we are only made possible by virtue of the kindness of the earth, so that we are always, if we're working on it, in gratitude to the earth. It also shows us that there's a kind of abundance, that the earth provides us abundance. You know, like if you grow zucchini, most people who grow zucchini, if you get lucky, you get too many zucchini. And then pretty much everyone, again, unless you're like a total nut, shares those zucchinis. It's just like how it goes as a gardener. And I sort of raise the question of like, oh, I think it's probably the case that we share when we're gardening, when we're gardeners, because the earth is showing us how to share.
Yeah, that's a beautiful point. And I also, I love the examples of basketball. And I was, by the way, a bad Division III basketball player. You know that about me. And
you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. And
because a bad Division III basketball player is a very good basketball player. let me be the one to say that. The bad Division III basketball player walks onto most courts as one of the best players on the court.
Well, I appreciate it. Doesn't feel that way anymore, but I appreciate that. And but I also love thinking about the comparison too of basketball and skateboarding, and that, you know, there are a certain set of rules, or there's a certain form, or there's a certain context in which these things exist. And there's also something that I love about the pickup basketball game and the skateboarding. And I say this in the most complimentary way, in that they're both kind of frivolous in a great way. They're about play. Yeah. They're about something that's not going to add up to making money. There's something else going on there that I find is really important.
Yes. You nailed it. And that's like, that should be another chapter of the book, Joy and Play. Because I think in addition to these sort of, what I think of as like, you know, radical endeavors to share, to remake the commons, to not claim territory, you know, and pick up basketball, like you can only call next game, you can't call the next five. You know, there are all of these things that they're reasonable, but in our kind of they're reasonable, but in the way that we mostly live now, they seem radical. But also this thing of play, which, you know, is what I understand of play. I'm not like a theorist of play, but one of the things that play requires we do is to always be curious. It's to sort of understand that as much as we know, we also don't know, and we have to sort of submit to and dance with what we don't know. And when we dance with what we don't know together, maybe that's another kind of opportunity for joy. You know, that's a new chapter in the book.
There we go. We got two new chapters.
Yeah.
But no, and I'm sorry. I'm just really thinking about pickup basketball. Sorry, listeners, if you don't play basketball, but I got to stay with this for a little bit. Yeah. But just, you know, I go back to almost one of the first things you read us, which is how we are culturally, and I think this is also financially, or the way that the economics of marketing works, which is that we are generally focused on the things in which we do not agree on. And we use those as these defining points between us. But suddenly it seems almost just radically beautiful, the idea of a group of people showing up on a court that no one owns just to celebrate what they do love, which is a sport like basketball. And you may have nothing in common with the people that are playing in that game, right? That's what's interesting. You may not even like them outside of the court, but in that moment, something is happening in which you're playing together, which just strikes me as really wonderful.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And it's like you've probably been on teams, or you've been on, you know, courts where you're on the team with someone who you kind of don't like.
Of course. Yeah.
And And but that person, for whatever reason, they know exactly how to feed you right where you want it, right in your shop pocket. They know how to do it better than anyone else. And it softens you to that person. But also there's this other kind of structure in pickup basketball, which is that, you know, because, you know, the team that loses usually sits down and then they wait to play next, for those of you listeners who do not play pickup basketball. And then that those people, the teams are constantly being reconfigured so that even if you thought you had an enemy for a second, if someone like made you look bad or someone was not nice to you, or like to me, I remember a kid, because I wasn't a good shooter. I remember a kid who would always say, "Let Ross shoot." God, that worked on me. But you know, the next game, we're going to be on the same team, or two games down, or three games down, or tomorrow, we're going to be on the same team. So it does not accommodate these sort of rigid boundaries of inside and out, us and them. It just doesn't do it, you know?
If you're just joining us, this is Life Examined on KCRW, and my guest this hour is Ross Gay, poet, essayist, and professor of English at Indiana University. His latest collection of essays, which we're discussing today, is Inciting Joy. When we come back, the delights and challenges of gardening. Ross Gay explains how being a good gardener can help you have a better understanding of life. And you can stay connected to Life Examined by finding us on Facebook. Go behind the scenes of the show, connect with other listeners, and tell us what you'd like to hear. Speaking of, how do you find joy in everyday life? You can find a link to the group at kcrw.com/lifeexamined or by searching in Facebook for KCRW Life Examined. We'll be back after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We just heard poet and writer Ross Gay share some of his surprising perspectives on finding joy, taking care of his sick father, and even playing pickup basketball, and how the discovery of joy through sorrow has impacted how he goes about living his life. Gay goes on to share some poignant details about caring for his father, how he'd noticed the littlest of actions, his reading, his smile, and his interest in researching his family tree. We rejoin the conversation as I ask Ross why gardening has become such an important part of his life. What did he learn from tending the land? Let's jump back in. Well, bring us back to your garden, because I know that's another thing that you have written about in the Book of Delights, but also maybe there's more to say about how you understand joy or inciting joy playing out there. I'd love anything else you could say about it, because I know this is a big part of your life.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. You know, I guess there's a couple things that I would say. And one is that, and this is becoming every day more and more evident to me, is that gardens are these sites of sharing, you know, and they show us, like I said before, they show us the sort of bounty of the earth. If we spend a little bit of time, and if we do not approach them as like war zones, if we're not like spraying Roundup and, you know, trying to destroy what we don't want in, which is kind of like that joy thing, you know, actually, you know, joy allows what we have to contend with into the garden. It understands that it's going to be in the garden, and it's fruitless to sort of war against it. So anyway, if we garden in a sort of way that is not a warring way, we get to see there's constantly these sort of interactions that are going on, you know, whether it be, you know, the bees pollinating all the plants that they pollinate, which is constant. Or in my garden, I don't like to say my garden anymore. In the garden, there's, you know, the sun, we grow sunflowers, and the goldfinches will eat those sunflower seeds and they will replant them for us. So I never have to plant sunflowers because goldfinches plant sunflowers for us. This is constant. You know, there are 10,000 things. If you talk about the way that the soil is working, it's just once you spend a little bit of time watching things, you know, the way that the beans are running up those sunflowers, they're growing up the sunflowers, and the beans are sort of like at the top of these some of these 12-foot sunflowers, just like reaching out and being held by these sunflowers. It's constant. And it makes it clear and obvious that the job of the garden, which is a site of sharing, or our job as gardeners in the garden, which is a site of sharing, is to continue the sharing. It's just like so obvious. So as I said, like once you get extra, you share. It's simple. And when other people have extra and they want to share, you accept it. It's very simple. So in a way, I think of the garden as kind of like a site or a practice zone or something you might call mutual aid or something like that. The other thing about a garden is that I just, you know, more and more day by day, I'm more and more moved by this, is that every seed that we grow, you know, or so many of the seeds that we grow, we should say, were brought forward by other people. They were preserved for our benefit. It's just like another one of the many examples of people who didn't know us loving us, you know. People hundreds of years ago, they didn't know us, but they loved us. And how did they love us? They brought us these seeds. They preserved these seeds because they loved these seeds, or because these seeds were tolerant of a certain climate, or because they were given the seeds were given to them by someone who loved them. So it's just kind of this archive of care.
There is another really great chapter in which you talk about a family reunion in Detroit. And I wonder if you could share a little bit about that and what it meant to gather generations and some of the themes you were pulling at.
Yeah, it's at the end of this gardening essay, actually, and it's one of the things that I sort of am wondering about, thinking about how gardens show us our connection, you know, ultimately show us that we're connected. And might incite us to be more connected, might incite us to see that. But at the end of this garden, I'm sort of like, at the end of this essay, I'm reminded of this family reunion where this one was in Detroit, and, you know, our folks came up from Port Gibson, Mississippi, and Osceola, Arkansas, and, you know, fleeing effectively from the Jim Crow South. It's my father's side of the family. And, you know, they were all there, and we're like doing the, you know, the talent show, and, you know, there's a riverboat tour, and Uncle Bennett's dancing better than like his nephew, who's like, you know, 40 years younger than him and everything else. And but the one thing, I mean, one of the things that I'm sort of I'm thinking about the family reunion as a sort of, again, another sort of archive of care, actually, an archive of generational care. But I'm also thinking of this moment where it's as happy as I've seen my father, you know, and I've seen my father happy plenty, but this was as happy as I've seen him. And we were driving into Detroit, going to the hotel, and I was driving the car, and my dad's reading. He was always reading in the passenger seat. And we were at a stoplight, and some dude in a truck pulls up, is looking at us. And eventually, my dad kind of looks at him, and they look at each other, and then they just start smiling, and they kind of like yell, we can, you know. And even I get so goddamn happy to think of my father that happy like that, you know. It just makes me so glad.
What do you think was happening in your father? What was he feeling? What was it about bringing these people together, these different generations, this shared history that might have brought something alive in him?
Well, you know, my dad was, you know, he was, you know, just like the rest of us. He was such a complicated dude, and there was, he was really sort of hurt, I think. For any number of reasons, and I wish he was alive. I can speculate plenty of them, but I wish he was alive so I could be like, why were you so, what precisely hurt you? Like I said, I can make some guesses. But his life was a fairly, I would say, like so many of us, was a fairly alienated life. Like he moved away from his family for work.
Yeah.
You know, he was a, you know, worked at like Burger King and Pizza Hut and Red Lobster and stuff. So he was far from his family. His work itself was alienating. You know, he was fired several times. You know, it's just like this kind of regular, miserable work. Mm. He was broke. So, you know, we were broke. So he was sort of like hustling and kind of scared always in a way. And I think, and you know, this is a thing my mother reminded me of, is that my father, toward the end of his life, started trying to fill out the family tree. Mm. And I have my dad's brother who's alive. He's the one of the three brothers who's still alive. He's more who I would expect to be doing that work, you know? And he and I have actually talked about sort of genealogical stuff. But I completely forgot that my dad, who had more distance actually from, we're from Youngstown, Ohio. I was born in Youngstown. My dad's from Youngstown. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. Yeah. But my father had more sort of distance from Youngstown. And there was a certain kind of, to some extent, I think he was probably, you know, running away from something, you know? Mm. There was some sort of sight of pain that he was maybe again, I'm speculating, I don't know. But that he was toward the end of his life trying to fill out the family tree and trying to sort of remember who were all of these people who came together effectively to make him is really moving to me, you know, to know like who, again, to know who it is who loved you. Many of whom you do not know. Most of, you know, of course, most of whom you have no idea. And my father, who, like I said, I would say, like so many people, lived a fairly alienated life, a life separated from whatever you'd call it, just say connection, you know, that toward the end of his life, he was really wanting to know who he was connected to, who he did belong to. That's so moving to me. So I suspect that what I was seeing in his face was a kind of glimmer of like, oh, we belong to one another.
Yeah. And I'm really moved thinking about, you know, we've all seen a family tree, which is just a series of names on paper and ink and, you know, directions moving up and down. But the way you describe it there reminds me that it's kind of a history of love in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just names. It's partnerships and people that came together in moments of bliss, but heartache and everything else.
Exactly. Many of whom survived. You know, like I mean, all of many of whom. Like when I say survived, many of whom, you know, like came through it. Mm-hmm. You know, to the extent that they did, if they did, you know, and that when I look at my family tree, on my father's side, I think of, oh, a lot of you all escaped, mm-hmm. you know? And that's part of how I got here.
Mm. When you say escaped, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I mean like, you know, being a sharecropper in Mississippi, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. being in an apartheid state. That's what I mean. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I, if you wouldn't mind sharing just kind of what that means to you, reflecting on a family that's been through that process and how that shows up in this book or in your work.
You know, again, it's sort of like one of these profoundly, like, it, you know, it's like another moment where I feel immense gratitude for who has given me my life. You know, and for what they've endured to give me my life, you know. I think in a way that's sort of the thing. Like, and I'm very curious about that, you know, but, you know, I was just going to say like a kind of epigenetic thing, like what is it that these people have provided me through the years. And among the things, you know, because we often talk about epigenetic trauma. That's a thing that we talk about. Mm-hmm. But I also think about epigenetic joy, because it's also the case that, you know, that in addition to sort of surviving, people were surviving, you know? So,
yes.
You know what I mean? So it's sort of like, I am the inheritor of many things. And among those things, you know, I got my epigenetic heads up. I think I see that in the book. But I also have my epigenetic, you belong to people. You have been loved. You are in the moment. You are in this moment being loved. You are being cared for. You have been beloved from before you came here. That also feels like a kind of, that's the biggest part in that suitcase that I carry around.
You know, this is a beautiful point. And we recently did a segment about, and bear with me here for just one second. It was about the history of Black or African-American philanthropy in the United States, and how it wasn't so much early on about the giving of huge amounts of money, but really it was about the giving of love and time, and about the ways in which those that were enduring those circumstances were also some of the most giving to each other and to their community. And I thought it was a really beautiful description. And it reminds me a lot of what you're saying now, that was the currency that one dealt in.
Yeah, I mean, we know this from experience. The people who have all the, you know, I'm not going to curse, but I want to curse. The people who have all the stuff, for the most part, keep all the stuff. Hmm. But which is not actually how we mostly are. Mostly how we are is that we share. Yeah. And so it makes sense to me what you're saying is that the normal ways of tending to one another, or the normal ways of being, is to tend to one another and to be looking out for one another and to be like, you know, I was just visiting with my Aunt Butter, who's one of the last, she's in her 90s, she's one of the last of this generation, and my Aunt Butter. And she's just constantly wanting me to meet my family. And which is not a thing, I think, three generations beneath her, we're kind of always thinking about. Mm-hmm. But my Aunt Butter is like, you need to know you belong to people, and you need to be prepared to care for people, you know, and to be cared for. And it's sort of like it's a sort of easy thing to forget in this world that sort of drives us into a kind of alienation that wants us to be alienated from one another. Because then we become dependent on institutions, and we become dependent on the benevolence of the people who hoard everything. When in fact, if we're dependent on each other, we're gonna be all right. You know, we'll be all right, you know. I think that's what they're teaching us. And I think you look at how people survive, that's sort of what you see again and again and again. It's not for the most part the benevolence of who's pulling the levers. It's each other.
Well, Ross, I'd love to end with a reading, and maybe we can just, as we started with the beginning of the book, we can now jump to the end. So tell us what we have.
Yeah, this is from the last essay in the book, and it's actually an essay about gratitude, joy and gratitude. Though it feels also like to some extent, an essay about joy and refusal. But let's say joy and gratitude. That's what it's called. It's the final incitement in the book, and this is the end of it, actually. And I mentioned the writer, the amazing poet and nonfiction writer Toy Derricotte in here. I think that's what the writer Toy Derricotte means in her poem, The Telecycle, when she says that, quote, joy is an act of resistance, end quote. The luminous mycelial tethers between us, our fundamental connection to one another, the raft through the sorrow, the holding through the grief joy is, reminds us again and again that we belong not to an institution or a party or a state or a market, but to each other, needfully so, which we must practice and study and sing and story and dream and celebrate, belonging to each other as though our lives depended on it. And when we sing like that, oh my heart, what then? Oh my heart, it's a real question. My heart, what then?
My guest this hour has been Ross Gay. He's a professor at Indiana University and the author, most recently, of Inciting Joy. Ross, somehow we've talked about basketball, life, death, skateboarding, gardens. I've loved this. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. It's so fun to talk to you.
All right, that's all the time we have for this week. Our producer on Life Examined is Andrea Brody. And if you want to hear more of Ross Gay, you can actually find our interview from 2021 in our archives at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. And now I would love to hear from you. Do you think that sorrow and joy are linked? What are small ways that you incite joy in your life on a daily or weekly basis? Please share any tips with our growing group on Facebook. You can find a link once again at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. Or by searching in Facebook for KCRW Life Examined. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Have a wonderful week. Thanks for joining us.